Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When it absolutely, positively has to be there overnight? Yeah, too bad. A big lump of coal for UPS and FedEx on this day after. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 26th of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Those of you, those of us who really did wait till the very last minute to do our Christmas shopping can thank UPS and FedEx for the awesome cover story, huh? Now all they need is a good excuse of their own. As you know, both companies had major delivery meltdowns this week. Perhaps as many as hundreds of thousands of packages meant to arrive before Christmas simply didn't. Debacle is too kind a word, and the whole thing does raise some real questions about the future of e-commerce and maybe because of our delivery infrastructure. Marketplace's Sabri Benishul reports.
Heath Thompson thought he'd covered every base, and come today he'd be on his way to the Caribbean. Then he forgot his passport.
I had a friend ship it on the 22nd.
Didn't arrive the next day, or the day after, or the day after. Luckily, a warehouse worker went searching for his package, and Thompson was able to pick it up hours before his plane took off.
It all worked out.
It certainly did not all work out for a lot of other people, and it boils down to this. Shippers predict what demand will be, and this year, they got it wrong. Satish Jindal, president of SJ Consulting, says UPS was expecting peak holiday delivery to run about 18 million packages a day. On Christmas Eve, UPS was looking at 34 million packages. FedEx was overloaded, too.
What was not expected and could not have been planned was the change in the weather patterns in the days leading up to Christmas Eve.
Now, Jindal is not saying that the weather delayed the shippers, but rather it paralyzed shoppers.
They were placing online orders that they otherwise would have gone to the brick-and-mortar stores if the weather was better.
Doug Fisher is a supply chain expert at Marquette University. He says with fewer shopping days this year, retailers also tried to snag as many last-minute sales as possible and pushed back deadlines.
It really compresses the logistics provider's ability to make those schedules and have any flex at all in their system. And I think we're reaching some of those boundaries.
But he says, keep in mind, packages are always delayed. But when it happens on Christmas, everybody notices. I'm Sabri Benishul for Marketplace.
If you've flown commercially lately, you're up to speed on a couple of aviation truisms, I'd wager. Planes are more crowded. Fares are higher. Fees are higher, too, like for checked bags. Still, things are getting a bit better for the airlines financially. They have consolidated. The economy is improving, which means an improving job situation if you want to work for one of the remaining airlines in this country. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Southwest Airlines has been doing better than a lot of its rivals, but it hasn't hired new flight attendants for more than 2 years. Last week, it announced 750 positions.
We received 10,000 resumes that were emailed to us within 2 hours and 5 minutes.
At which point, Southwest spokesman Dan Lanson says they closed the search. Southwest is expanding after its merger with AirTran. It's flying bigger planes with more passengers, and the rules require more flight attendants. They're paid close to $25 an hour for time flying, free travel thrown in. And these jobs have been scarce. Employment at the nation's airlines has been falling all this year. But with the economy getting better, analyst Seth Kaplan at Airline Weekly expects hiring to pick up, though not so much for jobs on the ground.
Every year you have more and more of people using kiosks at the airport instead of having to talk to an agent. They print their boarding passes at home or they get them on their mobile phones.
University of Portland transportation professor Richard Gritta says changes in the industry have made the job of flight attendant more stressful.
Now you're flying with planes that are full to the limit, more people being crammed in, fighting over space for their luggage because they're trying to avoid the checked bags fees. The pressure is ratcheted up and your wages haven't really.
Making it not so much of a pleasure to fly or work a flight these days. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit its 50th 5-0, 50th record high of the year. Details, numbers, when we get there. Even beyond everybody trying to figure out what the new thing is, what the next billion-dollar idea is going to be, there's a topic of conversation that's getting a lot of attention in Silicon Valley and in the tech world writ large, for that matter. Women. Why there aren't more of them in technology companies and running technology companies, for that matter, and how to change that. Marketplace's Queenie Kim has more.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Dinner number 53.
Welcome to the Geek Girl Dinner. It's waiting list only and one of the dozens of women-centered tech events that are popping up all over Silicon Valley.
What else? Yeah, if any of you work in a company that you think needs more women, which should be almost all of you.
Tonight's dinner is being hosted by Mozilla, the company that makes Firefox the web browser, and it's treating the Geek Girls to an open bar and sushi. Allison Voss was there hanging out with her friend Sarah LaFacette. Voss is an engineer, and LaFacette, an engineer in training. I asked them why they think there aren't more women on tech boards. Voss says in Silicon Valley, getting ahead depends on your network.
Every job I've ever had was through someone I had either worked with before or was friends with. Every single one.
And with men starting up about 97% of the tech companies in Silicon Valley, that means they dominate at networking. And that makes it tough for women to advance. LaFacette says that's not surprising. She says when you start any business, you want to do it with people you know.
Because you're going to see them more than you see your family.
And what that ends up meaning is, do I get along with this person? Do we want to go snowboarding together? And nobody you know is a woman. You know, those jobs just don't come to women, generally speaking.
Women in tech like Voss and LaFacette will tell you that they just need to work their way up. At least, that's when the microphone's on. But when the mic's off, they tell a different story.
Have you been to the fraternities at the universities? They're behaving as if still in the frat clubs.
That's Vivek Wadha, and as you might have guessed, he's not a woman. He's an entrepreneur and a scholar, and for the last 5 years, he's been researching a book on the subject of women in tech.
I've been interviewing hundreds and hundreds of women. They are afraid that they'll be ostracized, that they'll be labeled as feminists if they speak up.
He says there's a public narrative that says women are shut out of boardrooms and C-suite jobs because a pipeline to those positions are overwhelmingly male. But there's also a private narrative in Silicon Valley, and that's of startups that celebrate frat-like behavior and turn a blind eye to sexual discrimination. And he says women generally keep those stories to themselves.
They don't even tell you about how they go to conferences and they're groped. It's not everyone who's bad here, by the way. You know, there are a lot of men who have daughters or boys who had, you know, strong, supportive mothers and sisters tend to be a lot more open-minded about women. Many others feel intimidated.
I would venture every woman at one point in her professional career has seen something that was discriminatory to, you know, not being invited to the golf game or the ski trip.
Fran Myers is a serial entrepreneur. She co-founded the dating site Match.com, and she founded and chairs the board of TrustE, a venture-backed firm that manages privacy. Myers says she agrees women in Silicon Valley could speak up more, but then they risk falling into the angry woman category.
Nobody likes an angry woman. On the other hand, I don't think I'm angry. I think I'm pointing out what some of these issues are. But some guys might hear me and think I'm an angry woman. And who wants an angry woman on their board?
Myers says it's not just tech. All across America, the number of women on the boards of publicly traded companies has stayed stagnant for 8 years now. Countries like Norway, Germany, and France have tried to change the corporate culture by initiating quotas. And Myers says we might consider similar measures, too. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
It's entirely possible that I have never uttered the following sentence on this radio program before, but It's been a busy year in the hog market. Pork prices are way up. Bacon seemed to be everywhere. Ice cream, milkshakes, even Las Vegas martinis. And there was a government shutdown that meant farmers had no way to figure out how much their hogs were worth. Brian Duncan raises hogs in Polo, Illinois. We talked to him during the shutdown, and we figure now is as good a time as any, really, to touch base with him. Mr. Duncan, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
So we wanted to just check back with you after the shutdown and after the pork pricing issues you had, and just, first of all, see how business is going in pork these days.
Well, after the government got back to work and the prices started getting reported again, we had a nice counter-seasonal rally on the pork market. On the production side, the market's done what it usually does this time of year, and the market has gone down. So this is a tough time of year seasonally for pork producers to make money. There's usually a glut of supply at this time, and because of the holidays, there's fewer days of slaughter, so it kind of backs up the system.
I have to tell you, everybody to whom I tell that story about how you guys were figuring out pork prices during the shutdown, where you had to take these bits of the pig, right, the jowl and the cutouts, and reverse engineer them back to get the price of a hog. They all say that. What a ridiculous system.
Well. We can have lots of discussion on the price discovery mechanisms used in the live hog market.
How dependent are you, I imagine, on the inputs? And I'm thinking now of grain prices and corn prices.
Absolutely. And that's our bright spot going forward. We obviously, I'm sure you're aware, harvested a bumper crop this year in the Midwest,
especially of corn.
And the price of corn has come down, you know, 40%. And so that's reduced our break-evens a significant amount and provided at least the potential as we head into next year of some breathing room for us for margins on the production side.
All right. Well, then riddle me this. How come if your input prices are coming down and you got a good counter-cyclical rally like you were talking about, how come I'm still paying like $6 a pound for bacon?
No, you're shopping at the wrong store.
That's entirely possible.
No, when you go buy bacon, that's a value-added product. Seasonally, the packers do very well this time of year, and they are. There's good margins in that. I would challenge you, though, to go look at the bargains in the meat case. Take a look at, say, hams, which is also a value-added product, but are dirt cheap right now. You'll see that there are some values to be had in the meat case as far as buying pork is concerned.
Before I let you go, how's the next year looking for you?
We're optimistic. From the pork side, again, we think we get some relief on our inputs, which will help. And I'm still very optimistic about the opening of the Chinese market or the continued opening of the Chinese market. I think the Chinese purchase of Smithfield Foods will provide, hopefully, a tremendous amount of opportunity for product to be moved at an ever-increasing amount into China. And so as I look into next year, I can't help but be optimistic. I guess that's just kind of the nature of being in this business, though.
Brian Duncan. He raises hogs out in Polo, Illinois. Mr. Duncan, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai. I appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up.
This is not a place where you mess around. This is probably the most challenging place on the planet to drill for oil.
Black gold in the Great White North. But first, let's do the numbers. Trading was light, but plenty of leftover Christmas cheer on Wall Street. Today, the Dow Industrial shot up 122 points, 0.75%, 16,479. As I said earlier, the 50th record high of the year. The NASDAQ up 11 points, about 0.3%, finished at 4167. The S&P 500 up 8 points, nearly a half percent, ended things at 1842. Shares in Twitter continued their skyward march, closing up almost 5% today. Since that company's IPO last month, its shares have risen, get this, more than 180%. Investors appeared unfazed by holiday shipping woes. Shares in UPS up 0.2%. Shares in FedEx up almost 0.5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose oh so close to that 3% mark, 2.9993% to be precise. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace, so please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. On December 27, 1970, Hello Dolly closed on Broadway with 2,844 performances under its belt. Actress Charmian Carr turned 71. She played Liesel in the film The Sound of Music. I'm going to be singing all day now. And it's National Fruitcake Day. Eat it, regift it, observe in your own way. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and here is something for the stock pickers among you to look forward to. Right after New Year's, there's going to be a new smartphone app on the market, Robinhood. It's called, all one word, Robinhood. Wants to make investing in stocks free. Not that you're not going to lose money, but in that it'll save consumers the commission fees they usually pay to make trades. The company's website says it's all about letting everybody fully share in the fruits of capitalism. Sally Herships went to find out whether paying a fee for a trade is really what's stopping people from investing.
Aside from being broke, let's just get that out of the way, the primary barrier to investing is ignorance. That's according to James Angel, a professor of finance at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
I remember when I was starting out, I was an engineer, I had a college degree, I had a job, and I was clueless about how or where to invest.
Angel says consumers can be afraid of making expensive mistakes, so instead, they invest nothing.
If you put the money in the bank, it sits there, but at least it stays there.
Which Angel says could be better than making bad investments. Kent Smetters teaches risk management at Wharton. He says a free trading app like Robinhood could encourage poor strategies like day trading.
Usually people who trade frequently actually underperform the market.
But Robinhood says it doesn't encourage any particular investment philosophy. It believes in giving consumers freedom and tools. If products are tough to use, they'll turn off consumers. But Nan Morrison with the Council of Economic Education says ease of use is not enough.
For a reporter, you know, spell check is a great app. For an engineer, less so.
Morrison says education is the biggest obstacle for investors.
It was really easy to get a mortgage in 2007. Not such a smart decision.
Wharton's James Angel says low-cost options for investors already exist. But Robinhood says 50,000 users added their names to its early access list in just one day. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Our every now and then contributor from the BBC, Justin Rowlett, has a series he's working on. It's called Elementary Business, about the actual chemical elements that make the global economy go round. Today, chemical symbol HG, listed among the transition metals on the periodic table it is. Hey, Justin.
Hi, Akai. How are you doing?
I'm well. So, mercury, I confess I know not much about this particular metal.
Well, I describe it as the quixotic bad boy of the periodic table.
And bang, you just made it sexy. There we go. And also, it's toxic. I mean, that's the thing I remember. You had a thermometer in your mouth as a kid, you dropped it, and Mom always said, get away from the mercury.
Yeah, it is incredibly toxic, and it builds up. So if it escapes into water, it turns into a really toxic organic form of mercury and then is picked up by plankton and algae, and that's eaten by fish. So it builds up in the ecosystem and becomes much more of a problem.
It clearly, though, must have good uses, right? What do we use it for? What is it? How does it help the economy, Justin?
Mercury is a fascinating element, and it's captivated people since the beginning of time. It has an extraordinary relationship with gold, and it's used by artisanal miners, you know, small-scale miners, the guys who you see panning and sluicing for gold in rivers, and they use it to purify the gold. Mercury is one of the few elements that combines with gold. It creates a solution with gold, and what you can do then is you can burn the mercury off, and you're left with a residue of pure gold. And that produces about a third of the mercury that man releases into the atmosphere. The other stuff comes from coal. When you burn coal, it's released into the atmosphere. The other stuff comes from, I mean, remember the fillings in your mouth, Kai. You've probably still got some mercury fillings in your mouth.
So I guess the answer is we just need to figure out how to be safe with it, right?
Well, exactly. But actually, you know, there's very little that the world's governments agree on. But one thing they have agreed on very recently is that mercury is a bad thing and we should try a lot harder to stop using mercury. So they've recently passed a convention, an international treaty, something something like 92, 93 countries have signed it, including United States of America. Hmm. And it says we should look at the industrial processes that use mercury and do our best to get mercury out of the system. So, for example, we should encourage those artisanal miners to use methods that minimise the release of mercury into the atmosphere or get rid of mercury entirely. Alternatively, a fair trade organisation trying to work with these miners to stop them using mercury, they suggested cyanide or borax might be better materials to use. And I pointed out that these were themselves very dangerous. But they say that actually, within about 24 hours, both of those are neutralised in the environment. So actually, even cyanide is a better option than mercury, which says something about just how dangerous mercury is.
Think about that. Justin Roller from the BBC. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
After a year off, Royal Dutch Shell is going to dip another toe in the waters off Alaska next summer. The company said earlier this month it's going to start drilling again for oil on the outer continental shelf come July. It's a decision not without risk for the company after sinking $5 billion into the effort in 2012. Not a single well was drilled. Its rig ran aground and Shell racked up big fines for faulty equipment, pollution, and safety violations. So we asked Elizabeth Arnold to look into the state of Arctic oil exploration.
Out the window of this propeller plane, Wainwright appears below through the fog. It's in Inupiaq Eskimo village, wooden houses perched on a sand spit at the edge of the Arctic Ocean. We land on a short dirt runway and there's no one around, so I walk to town. Wainwright's the usual portrait of contrast in the Arctic. A polar bear hide is stretched over a satellite dish. Slabs of whale meat are in the bed of a shiny new pickup. Old ways and new money. Wainwright is the closest village to Royal Dutch Shell's most prized oil leases offshore. It's where an underwater pipeline would surface to move oil 300 miles across the tundra to Prudhoe Bay. A year ago, this place wasn't so quiet. Flights were sold out and the man camp was full up. But other than a lone excavator shoring up the eroding beach, there's no sign of any activity here today. Inside the tribal office, Ronnie Morales makes coffee and shakes her head over how quickly everything came to a standstill.
With their ability to just up and go, you know, that just really made it real. Like, wow, you know, that really happens.
The highest bid was $105 million.
6 years ago, at a standing-room-only auction in Anchorage, Shell spent $2 billion on leases in the Arctic, including a record-breaking amount for a single block just miles out from this village. But Shell had problems from the start. Support vessels were deemed unsafe. A rig dragged anchor on its way north. And last year, when Shell was finally allowed to start limited drilling, an ice floe 30 miles long and 80 feet thick shut down operations after just one day. The Coast Guard found multiple violations on one rig. The other snapped its tow lines and ran aground.
On Capitol Hill, 45 House Democrats are calling for the Interior Department and the Coast Guard to investigate the grounding of a Shell.
A month later, Shell announced it wouldn't try to drill in 2013. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says industry just wasn't ready.
Nobody wants to put their company at risk, their reputation at risk, or the environment at risk. And I think that that's what we saw in the lessons learned over the course of the last year.
Interior is now poised to issue new regulations for Arctic drilling.
This is not a place where you mess around. This is probably the most challenging place on the planet to drill for oil.
Marilyn Hyman is Arctic Program Director for Pew Charitable Trusts, which made its own recommendations a few months ago.
What we're asking for is a set of standards that every company who operates in the Arctic needs to follow. During the Deepwater Horizon spill, when the waves got to 6 feet, they stopped cleaning up oil. When it was dark, they stopped cleaning up oil. Those are normal conditions in the Arctic.
From the bow of this icebreaker, Healy, conditions are extreme, even on this bright blue spring day. The ocean is a flat plane of ice, so thick we have to back and ram every 100 feet to make headway. Building-sized slabs of ice fold and crash on both sides of the hull. The open black water behind us freezes up in our wake. The Healy is the Coast Guard's only working icebreaker in the Arctic. The nearest base and major port are 1,000 miles away. That worries Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, the commander of the Coast Guard here. Vessel traffic, he says, is on the rise, and much of it he has little control over.
As the North Slope of Alaska and around the northwest portion of Alaska down to Nome, as that all opens up and becomes accessible, we just don't know what we don't know. I do know that wherever humans operate in the maritime environment, sooner or later someone gets in trouble or there's some form of a disaster.
Despite the risk and Shell's pitfalls, Alaska's former oil and gas chief Ken Boyd says the Arctic is in play.
These are big prospects, and if you're hunting elephants, you have to go where the elephants are.
In a recent conference call over third quarter earnings, Shell finally broke its long silence over plans in the Arctic. CFO Simon Henry says the company will move forward on leases in the Chukchi Sea, which he describes as a multi-billion barrel opportunity.
Individually, it is the largest single exploration prospect in the Shell group.
And the company's just submitted a stripped-down exploration plan to Interior to keep its options open to drill next summer. In Wainwright, news that Shell may be back was met with skepticism. But village leaders are planning ahead for the day when offshore oil does begin to flow. This winter, they're holding hazardous materials training sessions and drafting response plans in the event of a major oil spill out on the ice at sea. In Wainwright, I'm Elizabeth Arnold for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we flash back to Sabri Benishour's story that started us off, the holiday troubles of FedEx and Amazon, of course, and in which, really, one can start to feel sorry for delivery companies in this day and age. Amazon said today that on Cyber Monday, that is, remember, the Monday after Thanksgiving, it sold 37 million items. That is 426 every single second. It is enough Crayola markers to draw a line around the world four times. It is enough miniature flashlights to light up four football fields to NCAA standards. Not mentioned, however, was exactly how many packages didn't show up in time for Christmas yesterday. Bah humbug. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this day after. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. You know my name, even though I can't say it. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is 8 p.m.